Good morning from 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. And welcome to our election special candidates forum. As each Saturday this month, we speak to one candidate running for local or state office. The program is brought to you with support from Rebecca's Natural Food and Hamilton's at First and Main. Now here are your hosts, Bob McAdams and Jeff Leonard.
Good Saturday morning, Charlottesville. I'm Jeff Leonard, general manager and founder of 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
And I'm Bob McAdams, Special Events Coordinator at WPVC.
Today we're co-hosting a WPVC election special, one of our interviews with Democratic candidates to represent the 57th District in the House of Delegates. Keep in mind, WPVC does not endorse any candidate for public office. We provide this information to you, our listeners, so you can help choose the best candidate.
And with us in the studio this morning is House of Delegates candidate Kathy Galvin. Kathy, welcome to WPVC.
Well, thank you for having me.
Kathy, let's start, as we usually do, by learning a little bit about you. Where were you born, and what was your life like as you were growing up?
I was born in Brockton, Massachusetts, which is just south of Boston, en route to the Cape. It was fondly called a working-class suburb of Boston. It was a shoe factory capital, actually during the Civil War. And my mother was a nurse, registered nurse. My father was an auto mechanic, didn't have more than an eighth-grade education. Growing up, some hard times fell upon us because my dad became very sick. He contracted many illnesses in the Philippines when he was a paratrooper that left him disabled, which made my mother the breadwinner on a school nurse's salary. But even in spite of that, my mother actually was a co-founder of a Head Start in Brockton, Massachusetts, and she had me volunteer as a teacher's aide as a second grader in a Head Start classroom. And that's where I learned the hard lesson of no matter how hard you think you have it, there's others that are really need more help than you do. And from that, I also kind of watched and saw how Brockton changed from being a pretty vibrant city to being one where the main street closed, and because all the businesses were drawn and corded out to the hinterlands as suburbanization hit, gobbling up all the New England farmland. I also saw the factories close. And that made me realize that there's some serious problems when unforeseen economic forces are undermining people's livelihoods and our natural resources. Made me go on a path to study geography and economics at Boston University. That put me on a path to study affordable housing and housing policy, which then put me on a path to manage assisted housing in Boston, where I met architects, was impressed by them, and they encouraged me to become one. That's what brought me to Charlottesville, Virginia, in 1983 to study architecture.
So that goes right into our next question about your education and your work background and how they have qualified you to serve in the House of Delegates.
I think fundamentally my experience has given me a rich understanding of the interface between economics and society. And also my professional training as an architect has taught me to look at things in a complete picture. I connect the dots. There's not one issue that matters more than another when you're trying to solve a problem. You've got to look at transportation, housing, education, jobs, all at once if you're going to solve an equity problem. So that's where I think my strength as an architect and my temperament combined with the skills have made me an effective school board member on the Charlottesville City Schools and an effective city councilor on the Charlottesville City Council. Because no problem is one-dimensional, and you got to bring a lot of people to the table in order to solve a problem. Inherently, as an architect, I'm a collaborator. I'm someone who tries to find the common ground. That's the strategy I've used, and that's why I've been pretty successful.
Now, you're seeking the nomination for delegate from the 57th District. What area does the 57th District cover?
It covers all of the city of Charlottesville, and then there are key precincts in the county around the city. Not all of the county, but it usually, it's easier for people to understand. It's usually like Mill Creek, Pantops, the area going further north to Forest Lakes and Dunlora. And then also you've got going further west to places like Bel Air and University Village. So that's kind of the general geography of the district.
Is there even a Republican announced for this race yet?
To my knowledge, no.
I don't think there is either. So this is June 11th seems to be it. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's 57th House of Delegates Candidate Forum. I'm Jeff Leonard. In studio today is Kathy Galvin. Kathy, how have you been active in recent years to help improve life in the city of Charlottesville and the Albemarle area?
How have I?
Yeah.
Works. Well, okay.
For people that don't watch city council.
Oh, sure, sure. So start back to my first day on the job as a school board member was in 2008. At that time, we had a serious problem with graduation rates among African-American students being around 60%. That was a huge challenge. So I immediately pushed to get access to what then Governor Warner had instituted, a way to assist school divisions to improve their efficiency and their orientation. So we got the MGT consulting firm to come in, do a stem-to-stern review of our division. And from that, we were able to get evidence-based practices on how do you close achievement gaps, from collapsing tracking to providing assistance for first-time college candidates. And then we also began laying the groundwork for the reconfiguration plan, which was bringing the fifth grade back to elementaries, having one middle school to limit transitions. And what I became a real proponent of was an early childhood development center, because the achievement gaps actually start well before kindergarten. And when you've got working parents who cannot afford excellent child care, like I did, but I also empathize, when I was a working mom, my paycheck went to pay completely for child care. That would be an amazing twofer, getting child care expenses covered as well as helping parents close the achievement. So those are some of the big things I worked on as a school board member, which now, when you look at the graduation rates today, they're around 95%. Last council budget session, we put a down payment on the design and engineering of the end of the reconfiguration of our city schools. Took 10 years, but I'm very proud of it. As a city councilor, took a lot of my lessons as a school board member, realized that the roots of the gap, the achievement gap, run deep in a city with a legacy of Jim Crow, massive resistance, and urban renewal. So taking my skills as an architect and an urban planner, I began to see, well, we've got to work with our community to have and revitalize neighborhoods without displacement. I'm very happy to say, over the course of that time now, we as a city invested mightily in the redevelopment of Friendship Court. Friendship Court is a beautiful model of how you can have parks and interconnected streets and a variety of income levels, on-site early childhood education, on-site job development specialists, to empower residents to take their own destiny in their own hands. So I just bring those and highlight those to say that what I started as a school board member, I was able to carry through to come to fruition this past spring as a city councilor. And it's extremely gratifying, but it's something that a lot of people don't realize, how much time it takes to get things over the finish line. It takes a lot of grit, a lot of staying power, a lot of relationship building, and it takes time.
You know, running for a seat in the House of Delegates, or for any political office, is a huge deal, and it takes a ton of sacrifice. When and why did you decide to run for this position?
I decided to run for this position when I heard that David Toscano was not running. And I was fully in support of David. In fact, David was the one that urged me to run for school board years ago. I have watched David. I admired his work, especially when he was driving down the insurance premiums that hit us hard a couple of years ago. Admired his work in education. I'm a huge proponent of preschool education being funded by the state, and fully funding education hasn't happened since 2007. So I was a supporter of David's. I was not going to run against David. I did, when I learned he wasn't running, it was an opportunity. I knew that two terms was really all that I felt city councilors should serve, for me personally, but it was time for other people to step in and take a shot at making the city the vision that they had for the city. I feel I left the city with a new city manager, with a new police chief, with a new communications director, and we're really beginning to change the narrative of the city away from one that we had on August 12, 2017, where it was a revelation of all the deep-seated racism and deep-seated discrimination of our African-American community. But those are things that I knew as a parent in the city schools and a school board member. So the reason why I decided to run for this seat was because there was an opportunity for me to take the skills that I've honed and, again, build on the relationships that I've formed over the last 12 years to then kind of exercise the work ethic that everyone knows me for, is that I put my shoulder to the plow and I get her done. Do that now at the state level, especially now I know the gaps. I know where we have to always ask for Mother May I to get things done in certain areas in the state. And I'm going to carry on working on chipping away the constraints that are placed on us by the Dillon Rule.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's 57th District House of Delegates Candidate Forum. I'm Bob McAdams, and with us in the studio today is Kathy Galvin. Kathy, you began to mention this just a moment ago. In the lead-up to August 11th and 12th of 2017, especially during the month after the July 8th KKK rally, Charlottesville City Council, and you were right there, struggled to deal with the permit request for the Unite the Right rally. What should the state government do to support any municipality in Virginia facing a similar, potentially violent event?
The number one thing that I saw that day, you know, in addition to, you know, the heinous screaming from the alt-right, the bigotry, the violence, the hatred, was the presence of automatic and semi-automatic rifles everywhere in my downtown. And I had just been that morning visiting Friendship Court and 6th Street Public Housing because I wanted to talk to residents, make sure they were feeling okay. There was the whir of the helicopter going around. People didn't understand what was happening. So when I had finished meeting everyone, I was crossing back across the mall, and that's when I saw the hounds of hell unleashed. And I'll never forget seeing the platoon of neo-Nazis next to the synagogue screaming, "They shall not replace us." And then I saw on my other side a phalanx of state police and riot gear. And then seeing armored vehicles race down to the downtown parks. So what I saw, though, was the weaponry. The weaponry was astounding. And the fact that only one gun went off that day was nothing less than a miracle. But I saw people's First Amendment rights to assemble and their own right to free speech, an opposing view, was being choked by the Second Amendment right to bear arms in the sense that it was like intimidating. So I repeatedly, ever since then, have gone to the General Assembly to advocate for gun safety and gun control. Both Senator Deeds and Delegate Toscano advocated for those bills as well as several others. And every year I saw the wall of resistance in committee, and I, backed by the National Rifle Association, that we couldn't get out of committee. I believe that when you can get those bills onto the floor for debate, there's enough Democratic voices and enough moderate Republican voices to actually get some of that legislation over the finish line. I wanted to get, I wanted to ban automatic and semi-automatics out of public places. That's including council chambers, all guns out of council chambers. I've seen people come with pistols on their hips and at the podium and then inflaming the crowd behind them. It's not safe. And again, it's intimidating and impinging upon others' rights that are in the Bill of Rights. That's what I will work at on diligently, is getting sane gun control and gun safety.
The events in Charlottesville on August 11th and 12th showed the overt racism of white supremacists. The Southern Poverty Law Center reports a rapid increase in the number of hate groups over the past 2 years. How should the General Assembly respond to the overt racism of white supremacy?
I think we have got to declare them as domestic terrorism. I'm not alone in that. The director of the FBI says we should call a white power movement out as it is. It's domestic terror. When you do that, you do have access to marshaling a whole array of tools from the FBI and local and state police. And the other thing that's important to take note, which I was shocked that happened immediately after Trump assumed office, there was counter-terrorism activity for domestic movements like the white power movement, just as there are to try to disengage people from joining Islamic terrorism. The Trump administration ended the funding for the domestic piece. I want to get that back at the state level because I want to make sure that we don't ignore the possibility of young people getting drawn into this movement because It's a way to belong. It's a way to make them feel empowered. And we've got examples of other places that have succeeded in doing that. When you look at the Protestant-Catholic reconciliation efforts in Northern Ireland, when you look at efforts in the Middle East between Israeli and Palestinians, we've got to de-escalate, and we've got to stop the division and the tribalism. And you got to get it at the young people, because they get drawn to this stuff. And with social media, everyone winds up being in an echo chamber where they just kind of feed into each other's hatred. And for whatever reason, human beings are built to just get sucked into hate. For whatever reason, it's a much more intentional effort to love.
The events of July and August 2017 also uncovered covert racism. It's embedded in our institutions over many years. Now, more than a year and a half has gone by since the August events. Where do you think we are now in race relations in the Charlottesville-Albemarle area, and where are we headed? And where do you think we are now in race relations in Virginia as a whole, and where are we headed?
Well, there's the old adage, you got to put money where your mouth is. So one of the big issues that in Charlottesville that relates to equity and justice revolves around, can people afford to live here? And people of color in particular, the longstanding residents of people of color here. So tackling the affordable housing crisis that actually has grown and more acute in the last 2 or 3 years, and that's because cities all over the country have become desirable places to live. People want to live in cities again. But when you come in and you have short supply, it increases demand, which then increases prices. Letting a laissez-faire attitude about our housing economics go unchecked is going to hurt us and make us a highly exclusive city, predominantly white, upper middle class, if we don't do something about it. So we began tackling that affordable housing issue this year in a very serious way. The city of Charlottesville has always invested in affordable housing. We have 8 times more public housing and assisted housing than any other member of the Thomas Jefferson Health District. And we spend about $120 per capita on affordable housing compared to like $20 per capita in Alma County. And that was last year. So since then, we've invested $10 to $11 million in affordable housing redevelopment and programming this year, tripled the amount of money we've invested. So that, I believe, we were spurred on by the events of A12 to make sure this is a goal. We got to make sure that we are dedicated and committed to maintaining the inclusivity and the diversity of our city. And we put money where our mouth
was. You know, prejudice comes in many forms. Women still earn less than men for doing the same work. And members of the LGBTQ community can still be fired without cause for simply being who they are. What should our state government do to overcome these injustices?
Well, with regards to women, we have got to pass the Equal Rights Amendment. And I know firsthand, I started off in high school realizing the pay differential between male and female. And it's not even as overt as the doing the exact same job. You're labeled differently, and your job category is then paid differently. Myself and another male colleague from high school, we were given jobs working in a lab, a water treatment lab in the Boston area, in the Brockton area. And I dutifully was the one who did a lot of the work. I was very studious at the time. I evidently still am today. And I would find out that I was getting paid less than my male counterpart. And I found out, I pursued that, and I found out he was labeled a laborer and I was labeled a clerk. 2 different differentials based on, I was a female entry-level job, he was a male entry-level job. I called and complained, but what ended up happening was I just simply told, you're lucky to have a job. So that was several decades ago. That still persists, and that's why I've been a champion, a fervent champion, with our growing opportunity programs, for example, that some of the best paying jobs are our skilled trades. And I'm an architect. I work with the skilled trades all the time. I know how much an entry-level carpenter can make, entry-level journeyman, electrical journeyman, HVAC, plumbing. And they get $20 to $22 an hour as an apprentice. An entry-level female going into nursing, for example, as a CNA, a certified nurse's aide, gets 10 to 12. So I've been encouraging women, okay, right now, you gotta say, you can do these entry-level male jobs. It's not just a man's job. It's your job. So we're moving forward that and in Friendship Court. And I think so. Number one, there's, you got to pass the ERA, but before that, you got to start making sure that you're not showing bias in how you promote job opportunities and job training opportunities. We did have a woman in our skilled trades growing opportunity program. I was excited by that. Now, with regards to the LGBTQ, another insidious thing that they're discovering, and it harkens back to the old redlining that used to be done with the African Americans, LGBTQ couples are being kind of denied mortgage assistance from banks and loan assistance from banks. So that tells me, and our Human Rights Act in the state of Virginia, we've got to make sure, and it currently isn't, we've got to make sure gender and gender preference is a protected class.
Thanks, Kathy. This is a great discussion. We can take a short break. And we're back. I'm Jeff Leonard, and I'm co-hosting with my friend Bob McAdams a 94.7 WPVC election special interview with 57th District House of Delegates candidate Kathy Galvin. Bob and Kathy, we're talking about the issues.
And the issues don't get any easier. Having health care available in a time of need, it's just a necessity for all people in our area. Lowering the high cost of health insurance is another need for many in the 57th District. What efforts by state government to address these real concerns do you support? What further actions are needed?
Thank you. And it is a major concern, especially in our area. A year or so ago, we had a terrible crisis where people had been kind of given only one option for a provider. I support the bills that were passed, many of them sponsored by Delegate Toscano, that empowered the Insurance Bureau to roll back the premium increases that were so devastating. We need to make sure that we are being fair and that we are using the regulatory powers of the state to make sure that people are not being abused and exploited. That's what allowed another competitor to come into the exchange, and we need to get more competitors into the exchange. So that's what I'm going to be working on in one aspect of healthcare to drive the premiums down. I think it's important that at some point Virginia is going to have a public option. That has got to be thoroughly researched. So one of those, because you don't know totally what the cost is going to be. And I think there was actually a study done to see about ways that the state could step in with more subsidies, and the costs were exorbitant. I think we need to use the Joint Legislative Audit and Review Commission, JLARC, to do the research, though, on a robust public option that would then be supported by state government. State government has got to step in because the feds are stepping out. Local government's already been picking up the slack on housing costs because the federal government has stepped out of providing housing and subsidies. And the local government has had to step in to cover education costs because the state has stepped out of paying for education. So the state needs to be figuring out and taking seriously its commitment to make sure that we have a healthy, secure workforce. It's good for the economy of the state. I will say we also need to expand the offerings of clinics. I'm very, very honored to say that one of the last things I did working with former counselor Holly Edwards was to bring the Central Virginia Health Clinic to Charlottesville. That was part of the federal program to bring health care to low-income people, particularly in the rural areas. But because of the severity of the poverty and the disparity in outcomes between black and white families, we were able to get them to settle in Charlottesville, Virginia. They now have a clinic on Preston Avenue based on a sliding scale. So you don't have to pay any more than what you can afford. That is a solution that also needs to be tapped over and over again, expanding our access to health clinics that provide different rates of charges based on income, and at the same time then deal with the premium problem at the state level by empowering the Insurance Bureau and then doing a robust study of the costs and implications of a public option.
Now, access to health care is a challenge for many Virginians, but getting health care for mental illness is even more of a challenge. Limits to insurance coverage and the lack of professionals in the field mean that many people with mental health problems just go untreated. What should the state do to help people with mental illness?
I just fully fund all the incredible legislation that Senator Deeds has been put forth. I mean, he's been a champion in that space. And I think the lack of beds is outrageous. So, and I think at this point in time too, it probably would do well to look at our community service boards. That's like members of Region 10. And I would like to take a look at how well we really are delivering mental health services. Has it become too bureaucratic? Has it gotten to the point where people are more concerned about, you know, filing the paperwork correctly as opposed to making sure they have the needs met of the individuals? So I think right now we need to take a thorough look at the functioning of the system we have in place now, which is usually through the CSBs. Because, you know, the awful situation that happened to Senator Deeds and his son was based on some things falling through the cracks in the system that we already have. So doing a thorough evaluation, making sure we're closing the gaps in the system we have, is number one. Number two, we need to expand that system. Right now, I'm very happy to say that I was on council and we fully supported the mental health court. So that just like drug court, we are now decriminalizing mental illness. That's also an important aspect of this piece, that we cannot be solving all of our problems with the first knee-jerk reaction is putting people in jail. And right now, sadly, prison is often where there is more wraparound services for mental health care.
Well, that leads perfectly into our next question. You're listening to the 94.7 WPVC's Charlottesville 57th District House of Delegates Candidate Forum. I'm Jeff Leonard, and with me in studio today, other than Bob McAdams, is Kathy Galvin. Kathy, as you were mentioning, mental illness leads to our criminal justice system. The superintendent of the Albemarle-Charlottesville Regional Jail has said 50% of the people in jail suffer from some form of mental illness. 80% have substance abuse problems. What changes in our criminal justice system are needed, and what can the General Assembly do to address this reality?
Well, I am a proponent of legalization of marijuana.
I saw you on television the other night.
After 5 years of looking at what other state governments have done in the area of legalization, we now have, it usually takes 5 years to do a drug trial on any drug before it's permitted by the FDA to get out in the market. Well, now our system of federalism has given us some time-tested results on how you can safely legalize marijuana. And there's also a medical component to marijuana. I mean, I've talked to two people in my time on council that have had a big impact on me who have suffered from serious epileptic fits. And so medical marijuana is the only thing that helps them function on a day-to-day basis. So, again, looking at the war on drugs and realizing, wait a minute, this is a recreational drug like alcohol, and then there's a very strong, effective therapeutic aspect to it. This is just got to take it out of the mix. When you do that, I believe we have to also understand that we've incarcerated a lot of people, primarily young black men, for minor drug offenses. We've got to commute those sentences. They call marijuana a gateway drug. It's a drug that's a gateway to prison, and that's got to stop. So I think at that point, that's probably going to be a steeper hill to climb without having majority Democrats in the House of Delegates. But I do think that we made great strides recently in a lot of efforts. For example, we almost got to the point where we completely decoupled fines from driver's licenses, court fines from driver's licenses for people that were coming out of prison. So I think, again, we already talked about mental and drug abuse problems. Decriminalize it, more fully resource our drug and mental health courts, and then we've got to make sure that there are great and consistent standards so that it's between these courts, so it's not so totally dependent upon the discretion of judges.
You know, I don't think people realize the importance of that town hall when Normal came through. I think it was Wednesday night. I mean, you had the chief of police, Rochelle Brackney, the elected Commonwealth attorney, Joe Platania, Dr. Bellamy, and yourself, and you were up there talking, and you were talking not about if marijuana should become legal. You were planning for when it becomes legal, and I'm sure the Normal folks are like, you mean we get all these people on stage with us? So, anyway, statistics reveal another issue with the criminal justice system. That is systemic racism. From police stops to prosecutors to incarceration, whites have a clear advantage over people of color. What should the General Assembly do to make sure all Virginians can trust that justice is equally administered by police officers, prosecuting attorneys, judges, probation officers, and prison staff?
I think one of the major lessons that the state could take from local governments in Virginia that have made some strides in this area. Virginia Beach and Fairfax, for example, have civilian review boards. We are in Charlotte are in the process of creating a civilian review board. When you have local boards like that digging into the data, you wind up seeing that there is a systemic bias in how and when people are pulled over. And part of it's related to, you know, being pulled over for drug use. Part of it is the police are getting calls in certain parts of town. And then there is a real strict procedure that they follow instead of having more discretion. So I think, number one, it's learning from the locals in this case. And I am happy to say that with Dr. Bellamy, co-wrote the resolution that enabled this civilian review board that is now working on finalizing an ordinance and set of bylaws right now. So the other thing I think it's important is to understand from the perspective, though, of the police departments and the police officer. Obama had a task force after Ferguson. It was on 21st century policing. And one of the many tenets was that the police need to be in the communities they serve. Now, our police department, our police officers can't afford to live in the city they serve. The police foundation has a housing assistance program, but it's very small in scale. The state government does allow local governments to have employer-assisted programs, but I think one of the main things would be to have a robust housing program that allows and supports police officers, and I will put in teachers, to live in the communities they serve. When that happens, you have much more understanding of the people you serve, and then the people that you serve have more understanding of you. I was really impressed. 2 years ago, I went to a conference in Seattle, and I got to visit a community that was a mixture of income levels, and it was a model of stormwater management as well as equity. And I got to meet a young man who grew up there, who, because of the relationships that had been formed by police officers that were in that community, lived there, did foot patrols, he decided to become a police officer. An African-American young man became a police officer. We need more African-Americans in our police force. But they've got to see why it's a good thing.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, Charlottesville, 57th District, House of Delegates Candidate Forum. I'm Bob McAdams. Kathy, the New York Times ProPublica report on the achievement gap between the races in Charlottesville and Albemarle schools, well, it alarmed educators, students, parents, residents alike. Both school boards and everyone in the school divisions have tried to address this problem. What role does the state government have in this problem, and what should the General Assembly do to address it?
Fully fund the standards of quality that they've been mandating since 2007 but have not been funding. They've got to fully fund after-school programs. We've got to expand pre-K education. I would like to get it as young as infant. To five. Not they fund the four-year-olds. We take care of our three-year-old programs, but 0 to 3 is when a lot of changes happen in a child's brain. So I mentioned that earlier. The biggest game changer that the state could do in terms of closing achievement gaps and closing income and wealth gaps between families, because it's like a college tuition to have your children in preschool today, would be to have state-financed pre-K education available to everyone. So that will be a number one game changer, because it will help parents also succeed. The other thing is supporting communities. And you see this on some level with the way the Virginia Housing Development Authority works in funding low-income housing developments. But they need to do a more robust job in terms of assisting communities to plan for a more holistic revitalization of very low-income communities. Right now, when investment happens, it usually winds up raising the value of the property and can often lead to displacement. But I, as an architect and a designer, I cannot in good conscience accept the fact that in order to have an affordable place to live, you have to live in substandard housing in an area that has no parks, is a food swamp at best, and probably a food desert, and has no street trees and no safe streets. That right now is kind of the model. So getting healthy, equitable, safe communities for all of our children where they can see their parents thrive will also make it easier for them to thrive. So I'm not taking the schools off the hook of making sure that they're treating all children fairly. I raised two sons. One was identified gifted. The other one was considered regular. The son that was not identified as gifted also had some serious health problems that inhibited his ability to focus. We would later find out that he had some challenges in learning. We finally got a 504 plan for him. That individualized learning plan was essential. I think we need to take that and that lesson everywhere. And I was able to advocate for my son, but I can understand if there's a bias by race and class, that's going to be a problem systematically.
You know, higher pay would make housing and everything else more affordable. Virginia has a minimum hourly wage of $7.25. A bill to increase the minimum wage in stages to $15 an hour failed in the Senate this year. The most recent Orange Dot report showed a great number of people in Charlottesville and Albemarle area who cannot afford to pay for basic necessities. What should the state do to address the income inequalities that bring wages up to a livable level?
I support the $15 minimum wage. It's also important to understand, all of us to understand, that many of our low-wealth families depend upon federal subsidy for their child care. They reach a certain threshold, and it can be around $15 an hour. They get to a certain income level, and they lose all of their child care assistance. So you can have a situation where that family is in the hole because they're making more money. That is unacceptable. That's why it's got to be paired up with early childhood education that's paid for by the state government. So as we move forward, we got to keep our eyes wide open. What is the implication of this, and how do we make sure that we don't follow the path of unintended consequences, which, as my Irish grandmother said, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Now, the other thing is housing. Now, local governments are empowered already to have employer-assisted housing programs, but I think we need to make sure that we do that for our own employees. That's what I advocated for years ago, because $15 an hour was not making a difference in that in their lives, and 80% of our staff live in outlying counties. It's still the case today. So an employer-assisted housing program actually would have been probably arguably more effective. Yeah. But it is what it is. You got to look at things in holistically.
You know, that leads perfectly into the next question is, when people live away from the urban areas in order to find affordable housing, they incur the transportation costs of commutes. What changes do you support to make public transportation a viable alternative to single-occupant car travel for both commuting and interurban travel?
Well, I have the pleasure and the honor to work with my colleagues on the Board of Supervisors on the Regional Transit Partnership. It's something that about 2-3 years ago, we formed these memorandums of understanding, and we made several of those focused on key issues plaguing our region, and transportation, public transportation, was one of them. So we have the Charlottesville Area Transit, which is the city program. We have Jaunt, which is kind of an on-demand call program. And then you have University Transit. And then we have a rideshare program. We right now are trying to improve function between those four entities through establishing memorandums of understanding. We're going to be actually putting forth to our respective elected bodies an agreement between Elmont County and CAT so that they know exactly what they're paying for, and if they want to add another route, they can know exactly what it'll cost. It's amazing to me that that hasn't happened until now. It's all been kind of gentleman's agreement, and there's been really not the same consistency in monitoring effectiveness. So that's number one, in my view, to get us to have a more effective existing system. Having said that, I ultimately believe we're going to need to move forward with a regional transit authority. And I say that because I've seen that work in other parts of the state, and I've seen it work because it has the ability to raise its own revenue. We got to get a more robust public transportation system with a bigger catchment area. Right now, our city residents can't get to Airport Road because the bus routes don't get there. Why do I say Airport Road? Because there's great precision manufacturing out there. pay excellent jobs, excellent wages, and our people can't access them. So that's why this is also an equity issue. It's also a land use issue. I've worked on the hydraulic planning and advisory panel, which was a small area plan for the Seminole Trail area. We need to get more compact, higher density, but with high quality of life. That plan came up with a promotion of affordable housing. But that plan paired up with what the county's doing at Rio Road with their small area plan will create compact centers all along 29 that sets the stage to enable a bus rapid transit. That's what's working right now in Richmond to great effect. So you get to the point where you have excellent buses, electric buses. You get 40 people off the road in one car, as opposed to having 40 cars on the road clogging up the arterials.
All right, thanks, Kathy. We need to interrupt this and take another short break. And we're back. I'm Jeff Leonard. I'm co-hosting with Bob McAdams, 94.7 WPVC election special interview, the Charlottesville 57th District House of Delegates candidate Kathy Galvin. Bob and Kathy, we have one more segment to talk about the issues.
Now, Kathy, recent reports from scientists tell us that the climate change crisis is much worse than previously understood, so that we've got years, not decades, to act. Young people who understand the urgency of this crisis are condemning the lack of action by older people who are the ones in positions of power. This crisis overlays all the other problems we have discussed. What should state government do to accelerate reduction of greenhouse gas emissions and hasten the transition to renewable energy sources?
I've been a champion of the regional greenhouse gas initiative locally. Every year I put in our legislative packet request to the General Assembly that Virginia become a member of this regional cap and trade program. That includes New England states, mid-Atlantic states. Virginia would be the very first southern state to join a regional cap and trade. Just last week, it's called the Air Commission, and we have representatives from Virginia on that commission, majority voted to have Virginia join the regional greenhouse gas emissions collect. Now, what happened, though, is, and the Dems support it, Governor Northam supports it, but with the budget recently, there was a little rider put in place by the Republicans that said Virginia cannot become a member of the RGGI. I am asking everybody to call on Governor Northam to exercise his line item veto power to scratch that out. When we get Virginia in a regional cap and trade program that's going to set the ability to have targets for metric tons of CO2, and every three years they reevaluate those targets, it'll drive the local industry in energy to move more towards renewables. That's wind and solar. Already 10% of the market is in wind and solar, and Charlottesville is a champion in that space. So again, the state can be the driver of standards simply by making these expectations clear in the energy industry. No surprise, Dominion Energy does not support the RGGI. I will not take any contributions from Dominion Energy. That is a monopoly that needs to be untangled. So the other major component of greenhouse gas emissions is the transportation sector. So the RGGI will regulate electric usage, right? So transportation, though, is the other big component that pollutes the air and causes greenhouse gases. Moving towards a more robust public transit system within our district, getting more cars off the road, getting our buses electric will be a game changer. And I would love to expand upon our growing opportunity solar program, which we've already had 8 of our city residents go through. 3 of them were immigrants from Afghanistan. 4, 5 of them were then African-Americans who were changing the trajectory of their families. Let's expand that. We expand that by expanding the industry. I have a dream to have Proterra, which builds electric buses in South Carolina, to have a plant here. Why can't we repurpose some of our failing shopping centers in the county to be a Proterra manufacturing plant within our bus catchment area? So that's what we can do. We're on the cusp of doing it. But I've been in this space ever since I was in high school. I looked through the world, and equity and sustainability have been the lenses I see things for a long time. It just takes a long time.
Now, all candidates, they have aspirations for problem solving, but eventually they meet the limits of the state budget. How do you think the General Assembly should reconcile the needs for real change that we've been discussing, reconcile that with the level of revenue coming from current taxes, and what new sources of revenue could the state use to meet the needs of the people?
Well, I'll start with the new revenue sources. I think one of the state tends to rot Peter to pay Paul, okay? So transportation has been a real drain on a lot of the state coffers because the state legislatures have been refusing to replenish those coffers. So the gasoline tax hasn't been increased for quite some time. The gasoline tax is actually obsolete at this point because we are getting more fuel-efficient cars, and if we move towards electric, it'll be totally useless. We've got to move towards a vehicle miles traveled taxation regime. And I believe, given the challenges that we've seen with I-81, for example, and there in 2013 there was a transportation bill, that seems to be the one area where you can start finding common ground with your Republican counterparts because they understand transportation is the backbone of a strong economy. I happen to think it's also the backbone of an equitable economy. So that when you do that, you get the state really taking charge and taking full responsibility for our infrastructure. Maybe they'll stop raiding the lottery fund. The lottery was supposed to go towards education, but there is no money left because it's being used for other things. So you got to be strategic, and which way of raising revenue do you think has got the most chance of winning? And transportation, what I've seen, has been the one that resonates with everybody all over the Commonwealth. I do believe we would do well to raise our state income tax. Can I get that done in the General Assembly? We have a majority Democrat? Yeah. Because when I look at my tax bills every year, the biggest tax I pay is local. Because, again, the locals are taking care of housing and education and, to some extent, transportation. But that brings up the one other thing I want to do is work towards making local government have more access to progressive taxation tools. And I've been working on right now is the real estate tax. We can't touch it because our evaluations, our assessments are going sky high. Raising taxes on that rate, that millage rate, will only hurt low-income homeowners and renters. But if we move towards having a homestead exemption where you take off the first $75,000 or $100,000 of the value of a home so that it really clears the way for low-income homeowners and renters, and then you then have a tax circuit breaker where you cap people's payment of taxes on real estate by income, and I actually put this in the package last year, the state would reimburse that locality for the differential, then you're really doing something in terms of helping the local government solve their local problems, which I think is a better way to go, but giving them the means to be doing it progressively.
For local governments to meet the needs of their residents, they must have the authorization from the General Assembly, either through general laws applicable to all or through special acts of individual local governments. Why do you think the relationship between the General Assembly and local governments, or what do you think the relationship should be between the governments?
I think that the entity that is the closest to the people governs the most effectively for the people. That said, local government should be empowered in most areas to handle their own problems instead of going to the General Assembly and asking Mother, may I? One area in particular that I will be working on is to give Charlottesville City the authority to have inclusionary zoning. What that means is that you require the developer to build on-site affordable housing. Right now, it's a carrot kind of approach where you give the developer options. They either pay into a fund, they can build it off-site, or they build on-site. Endlessly, the developers just pay into a fund that doesn't even cover the cost of building a unit. So that's an example of how the Dillon Rule is what it's called, hampers local governments from solving their own problems. Now, whether you go head on and say you want to get rid of the Dillon Rule, I don't think that's going to be feasible because guess what? When the Democrats were in power, they didn't do anything about it either. There's something about power that kind of tilts people a little bit. So I would love to convince my colleagues in the Democratic Party that I'm a member of that local governments are the ones that should be empowered to do the problem solving in their communities. And I see it from personal experience, but it's not something that I would go about head on. I would do it bit by bit.
You know, the first rule of power is people that have it like to maintain it. People often feel frustrated by the lack of action by the General Assembly. The government system in Virginia seems designed to prevent change. The General Assembly is in session for only 60 days, and other years it's in for 45. In that brief time, legislators consider thousands of bills, most of which are killed in subcommittee. How do you plan to get things done in the General Assembly if you're elected?
Well, the problem with killing bills in committee is a big one. It's huge. The surefire way of changing that is to change the party in power. Because the way the committee structures are run, the chair is appointed by the party in power, and then that chair gets to pick the majority of members of the committee to be the party in power, and they also get to pick the minority party members. So it's totally up to the party in power to create the dynamics in the committee structure. Now, having said that, I go in there again understanding I've had to work across boundaries before, trying to get, for example, to have our county supervisors agree to keep all of our courts downtown. That was a social racial justice issue in my mind. And yet the members of the Board of Supervisors were also looking at it a way of being an economic driver. With quiet, careful negotiation, bringing in members of the public to assist with conversations over coffee, we succeeded in making sure that we kept all of our courts co-located downtown for the ease of the people that needed the court system. I think that is the strategy that you can be moving forward with people that on face value don't agree with you. One of my good friends, La Charisse Aird, she's the delegate from Petersburg. We were both in the Sorensen program together in 2015. I admire her work because she, too, in her district has high poverty, very big achievement gaps between black and white students in public schools. She teamed up with another delegate from Southside Virginia, a Republican, who had the same sort of dynamics in his high poverty district. High poverty, underperforming schools. They teamed up and realized that what they needed was to find ways to attract good employers to their communities. So they co-wrote a piece of legislation that would make it easier, not harder, for businesses to relocate in their communities to provide good paying jobs for their constituents. That to me is the kind of work that we need to be modeling over and over again.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's 57th District House of Delegates Forum interview with Kathy Galvin. I'm Bob McAdams. Kathy, in the June 11th primary, you're running for the Democratic nomination for delegate from the 57th District. Because Republicans in the 2011 redistricting herded as many Democrats as possible into the 57th, in the June 11th primary, voters will probably elect the next delegate. But how do you engage voters in this June election? And how can voter participation be increased in all elections?
In this June election, it's old-fashioned methods of pounding the beat, knocking on doors, and getting on the phone. I am doing all of that while I am still a city councilor, and I'm still teaching a class at UVA. That will be over next week. So there's no cutting corners on that one. Forums, meet and greets, all over the place. It's a matter of getting the name out, making sure people know I'm running for the House of Delegates, and getting my message out, which is I'm experienced leadership for progressive action. Now, in terms of getting more voters out, I think with the Democratic primary, you do get probably the smallest turnout of the electorate. They come out for the general, and they usually only come out for the presidential. So making it as easy as possible for people to get to the polls is critical. I've advocated for making Election Day a holiday. Make that also the case for primary days, both parties. But I also think it's very important for people to understand the money, the big money that's involved with elections. And when a big corporate donor or an individual with deep pockets begins to invest mightily in one candidate or another, in my view, that lessens the voice of everyone else. So I would be very much in support, and David Toscano, I put this bill through, but it didn't pass, putting caps on the amount of money that delegates can accept when they're running for election or re-election.
But every campaign, you need to pay for the basics to get your message out as possible, to as many people as possible. You know, in the same time, corporate money and corporate lobbying are seen as preventing government from taking action on the real issues facing people. How will you raise the funds to pay for those basics for your campaign? And again, what do you think should be done about the influence of money in state politics?
So I am not taking any contributions from Dominion Energy. It's a big public utility that is regulated by the legislators, that it should not be then giving money to those same legislators. I mean, that's an inherent conflict of interest. So just get that off the table, even though that was a mighty contributor for decades in the General Assembly for both parties. I think now, I said earlier, I believe that we need to be capping the amount of contributions that delegates receive. North Carolina has a cap. I think it's like $5,400 per delegate as to what they can get from any one donor, be it a corporate or individual. It's to me, it's kind of unfortunate that North Carolina, in this case, is doing better than we are. So I will be advocating for a cap. The number that was put out there by Delegate Toscano was $10,000. I can't do that right now. I've got to raise money to get the mailers out, to get the postcards out, to make sure that we've paid people that we need to pay to get the word out, and the assistance. I've got a good campaign team, but I believe in paying people for the work they do. So it's very hard. I'm not denying it. It's 10 to 15 hours of my time has to be on the phone asking for money. And I want to be out in with the public talking about the issues that concern them. But it's a catch-22 right now.
So let's say I run into you in the street. What's your elevator speech?
I say, good day. How are you? and I'm Kathy Galvin. I'm running for the House of Delegates, the 57th District. I will provide the progressive leadership with the progressive action that this region needs to move us towards a more sustainable, equitable future in a world that's just, safe, and healthy for our children. I say that because it comes from my experience growing up in a working-class community where I saw people living a hardscrabble life against all odds, sometimes not succeeding. That informed what I wanted to study in Boston University and ultimately got to be an architect in Charlottesville, Virginia, where I used my skills to be involved with growth management in the county and building affordable rehabbed housing in Charlottesville.
So what's the best way for people to get in touch with your campaign, to learn more about you, volunteer, or donate?
Well, you can get in touch with my campaign by going to www.galvinfordelegate.com. That's my website, and there are the various buttons there to donate and volunteer. Also, there's a brief outline of my platform. You can also send checks, always accept checks, to P.O. Box 2813, Charlottesville, Virginia, 22902. And I will be out canvassing this Saturday. You can please join me at my home. I live 712 Lyons Avenue. We're going to be starting the canvassing at 10 o'clock. I'm also having phone banking every Thursday night. You're welcome to join there, too. Again, when you get to my website, the volunteer opportunities are there. It is a community-driven campaign. I am the local girl. I've been here 35 years. I love this place. I love the people in it. I'll muster every skill I have, build on every relationship I've built, to work with you every day to create what we all want, which is a beloved community where everyone has access to the bounty of this beautiful world.
Well, thanks. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. Kathy, thank you for spending this hour with our WPVC listeners. This is one in a series of election special interviews with candidates in our area seeking the nomination for city council, county supervisor, delegate, and state senator in the June 11th primary. Each of the interviews will be available on podcasts at our website, 947wpvc.org, after they've been broadcast. We thank Kathy Galvin for giving us her time so that you, our listeners, can make the best choice for nominees for delegates representing the 57th District. Next week, Delegate candidate Sally Hudson will be in our studio as our guest. Thanks for listening to 947WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
You've been listening to the 94.7 WPVC Election Special Candidates Forum. The program is brought to you with support from Rebecca's Natural Food and Hamilton's at First in Maine. Join us again next Saturday at 11 as we talk to yet another candidate for local office in Virginia's 2019 off-year elections. You can hear this program again or suggest questions for upcoming guests at 947WPVC.org or link to it through our Facebook page. Thanks for listening.